From card tricks to seances, there are lots of techniques that give us a few thrills while pushing us out of the comfort zone of our belief systems. Today's guest spent much of his life exploring those belief systems and how we come to embrace them. Ray Hyman is both magician and mentalist, skeptic and psychology professor. He came to the Rogue Valley at the invitation of the Jefferson Center, no relation to JPR, to talk about science and physics, scientists and physics to be exact. So obviously some of his critical analysis focuses on the hard sciences, not just the paranormal. Ray Hyman has been published so many times it's hard to keep track. His published research has been in pattern recognition, perception, problem-solving, creativity, and related areas of cognition. Ray Hyman, thanks so much for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange.
You got the title of my talk wrong.
What was it?
As Scientists and Psychics.
Scientists and Psychics. Oh, there it is. Look at that. Well, that makes a whole lot more sense,
yeah,
than, doesn't it?
It's a little bit different than scientists and physicists, whatever it is.
Yeah, note to me, don't read small fonts without the reading glasses on. All right, scientists and psychics, great place to start. So I think, you know, obviously a different level of depth of understanding and supportability. This is really what you seem to have focused your career on, is whether or not there are the facts to support your case.
Yeah, well, my interest has always been on thinking, and thinking that goes well and successful, you know, creativity, the arts and stuff, and thinking that goes wrong. People goof, do very bad, stupid things. And the idea used to be that these are two different kinds of things I'm studying. Turned out it's the same thing. In other words, the very same things that make us such great successes at problem solving and creativity are the same things that also get us into trouble.
You started, I understand, as a kid, doing magic work, and you're a bit of a mentalist, too. Tell us about that.
Oh, at age 7, my father gave me a few tricks for my birthday, magic, and I practiced them, and I took them to school and did them for what they call, you know, the show and tell. The teacher thought it was probably cute, a little kid's doing the magic. So she said, would you be willing to do that for the Parent Teachers Association? Of course, I said yes, and I did it, and they paid me $5. Now, I'm 86 years old, and $5 back then was a lot of money. And I went to a printer shop nearby, and he printed up cards for me, business-like cards, with a rabbit on it, and it said, and I lived on Mystic River, so he called me the Merry Mystic. And I distributed these cards all over the city. I lived in Everett, Massachusetts at the time. I distributed it everywhere, all over the place. And sure enough, I got the library hired me for its story hour. They paid me a little bit, and I did. And then other places would hire me. And from then on, it just snowballed, and I decided I'm going to become a magician. And the first thing when I was able to go to the library and find a book, the first thing is I found the book about Harry Houdini, the magician. It was written for children. And I read it, and I saw that Harry Houdini was not only a great magician and escape artist, but he also spent a lot of his career debunking fake spiritualists and other phony psychics. So I got in my head as a young kid that that's what a magician has to do. So if I'm going to be a magician, I also had to be a skeptic and expose fakery of all kinds.
And what was the first time? Do you remember the very first incident you did that, where you debunked somebody else's work or took on somebody else's belief system or creation?
Okay, well, I never like to be a debunker. I don't want to insult people or hurt their feelings. I just want to understand why they believe things that from my point of view, I know is not so. You know, they have no basis for believing it. So I just want to understand it. I never wanted to, you know, put them down. And I'll now know from the way I study it that the fact that you can be wrong is not a reflection of how smart you are. You know, you can be smart. Being smart, it doesn't mean that you're gonna be immune from being wrong.
So you can be taken.
In fact, the smarter you are, probably the easier it is to take you.
Why do you think that is?
Well, because smart people are smart enough to know how to defend themselves, you know, so that when you try to show them that they're wrong, they have very clever arguments. Once they have committed themselves to something, they can use their smartness to outsmart you, in other words, to defend their position.
So you were on your way to a journalism degree, I understand.
Right.
And so what diverted you off into psychology then?
Well, at the time I was a journalism major, I was also trying to make, I used to make my living doing magic of various kinds. And then I discovered when I was in high school that people pay me more money if I did what's called mentalism, as I do what a mind reading type of act. Mm-hmm. If I pretended I could read their minds and I could predict things, they pay me much more money. And so, even though I prefer to do magic tricks, with cards and stuff, I found I got much more money by just doing mentalism. But then I couldn't travel because I was always a student. I went to high school, then I went to college. And I was hired by organizations, the Rotary and the Kiwanis and all kinds of local groups.
We have to take a short pause in the story. We'll come back and talk about you being a mentalist and how it led to what you ended up doing. Ray Hyman's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the University of Oregon and a worldwide known skeptic. Back in the Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service, I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Dr. Ray Hyman, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the University of Oregon. Been out of the full-time teaching game for a number of years now, but still going strong. Talking about skepticism and deception and why people believe the things they do. That's been a lot of his work through his career. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You can check us out on Facebook as well and get a picture of Ray's bright, smiling face here in our studio. So you were talking about working as a mentalist while you're in college, working toward a journalism degree, and how you ended up with a psychology degree instead.
Well, I actually worked as a professional mentalist for about 6 years, actually, I think from high school until I went to graduate school in 1950. And the problem I had was that always being a student, I couldn't travel a lot doing my mentalism. So I was having to sell myself to the same groups over and over again every year, which means I had to find a different thing to do each year. I couldn't do the same.
Because they could all say, I've seen this before. Yeah.
Right. And so I took up other things. I did hypnotic shows for a while. I did memory act. I did a variety of things. And then I worked a couple of summers in a type of carnival type show where they had different booths. They had freaks and they had other things and they had magician like me, and I thought maybe I could get something from those people. They were willing to teach me. There was a sword swallower. There was a guy who climbed ladders made of swords. And it was very dangerous, even though they were willing to teach it to me. I wasn't comfortable doing wanting to learn that. But there was a mid camp, they called it. It was a lady who did palm reading. And I thought that was safe.
Right.
And I didn't ask her. I don't know if she would have taught me, but she did anyways. I did watch her several times. Then I went to the library and got books out on palmistry. And I learned, of course, they contradict one another, but I'd read enough of them. I'd set myself up as a palm reader.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I couldn't do that on stage like I did my other acts, but there were churches and other groups would hold benefits, and they'd have fairs. And at these fairs, they would have booths where people came and did and charged to do something like get their amulets made or something like that. And so I set up as a palm reader. I worked with many of those things. I would have a booth at these fairs, and they would pay me a fixed amount of money, and everything at the booth I took and went to them. Or sometimes everything they up to a certain amount that I took in went to them, and then after that was all mine. We had different arrangements like that. And I did that for a number of years, and as I up to when I was a sophomore in college. And I was surprised because I'm a skeptic about all this. And with palm reading, you tell people very specific things. You can look at their lifeline and say, well, at this age, you must have something wrong with your head, you know. And, and people surprised me. They would say, of course, yeah, how did you know that? I fell on my head from a tree or something like that at age three, and you said at age three I had something wrong with my head. And so I was getting enough of that feedback, and I didn't understand coincidence and everything that I understand now. So it impressed me that even though I don't believe this stuff, there must be something special about palmistry. And it made sense a little bit because the hand's connected to the body and so on. And so I was almost a believer in it. And the all to the point, I remember the president, the chairman of the Department of Psychology, where I was majoring journalism, he heard I was reading palms for money. He called me, he sent me a note, and asked me to come to his office. I came, and he ushered me into his office, and he was a big, tall guy, and I'm not that tall. And he was a very imposing fellow. And he closed the door in his office, and he gave me a real dressing down. Don't you know that you're getting money under false pretenses? This is all a hoax. I mean, it's a fraud and stuff like that, and you're going around making money off this, and it's terrible. And he went on and on and on. Somehow it didn't bother me. I just sat there and let him rave on. And when he calmed down, I said, could you let me see your hand? And he gave me his hand, and I gave him a reading. He didn't say anything. I left. And I think it was about 2 weeks later, I got a note from him again saying, something asked me to come to his office again. So I came. He ushered me into his office. He shut the door, and he put out his hands. He said, tell me more.
And this is the psychology professor.
Right. He was the chairman of the psychology department at Boston University. That's where I was at that time. And at that time, also, a friend had told me while I was reading palms, asked me if I would. He used to sit outside and listen to what I was doing. We were discussing between. He said, Ray, he said, why don't you, just as an experiment, read everything backwards. If it says that this lady, the hardline says this lady doesn't like the show of emotions, says she really just loves to display her emotions all over the place. If her headline says she's rational, say she's very intuitive and impulsive. So I trusted this fellow, so I did it. I read everything wrong, and I was really upset because this woman was rigid, this client who was telling everything wrong from my point of view. She was absolutely rigid, and usually you get a lot of feedback from people when you give them reading their palms. When I'm telling them things they want to hear, they're pushing their hands towards me. Right. When I'm telling them things they don't want to hear, they're pulling their hands away from me. And sadly, but it's like they're helping, they're shaping the reading. And I rely on that feedback. And she wasn't giving me no feedback at all, and I said, oh boy, because I'm telling you everything wrong, and I bombed. Well, it turned out, at the end of the reading, when I talked to her, she was so stiff and unresponsive because she was in a state of shock at how accurate I was.
Really? Even though you'd deliberately gotten everything back?
Yeah, I was deliberately telling everything wrong. I tried with a few more patients, and it turned out it didn't make any difference what I told them, what the line said, it told them something else. I got the same good reaction. They took it the same. And I realized that whatever was going on, he had nothing to do with the lines in the hand. And at that point, I decided I'm going to change my major to be a psychologist so I could understand why most people, including myself at that time, thought there was something there when there was nothing there.
So what is that nugget, then, of human psychology that makes us devote ourselves over to things that you would think we would know almost instinctively? It's like, well, you can't tell much about a person's life just by looking at the lines of their hand, other than maybe that they've been working in the fields a lot.
Well, that's an area called cold reading, and I have written a lot about it. I do workshops on it, and if you go to YouTube and type in Ray Hyman cold reading, you will access a full 2-hour workshop that I do on cold reading. They videotape and it's on there on YouTube now. And what I do in this workshop is I teach people who've never done reading, who aren't psychics, I teach them within a few minutes how to do it and to do it so they can go out now and be as good or better than people who don't consciously know what they're doing. They're just what we call shut eyes. They just they basically just do it and it works. But I can teach people so clues that they're even better because they know what they're doing and can go convince people. I have been doing these workshops since 1980-something all over the world. And the center of my workshop is I pair people off in the audience, hopefully you don't know each other, and I teach them quickly to scan each other, look at each other, look at their hair, and make some judgment about what kind of person would have their hair this way. Look at their face. Are they having any makeup? Do they have acne marks? Does that say anything about them? I just have them scan the person for about 10 minutes or so. And then I have each of them give each other a reading based on that. And I then have them, each person rate on a scale of 0 to 100 how accurate the reading they just got from that person who never did a reading before, how accurate it was. The average over these since the 1980s, the workshops I've done, and including the one I did, the average is usually around 85% accuracy.
Really?
Yeah. So, and people are just amazed. And many of them are skeptics, by the way. I sometimes do this for skeptics groups. So it's very easy to do. People don't know it, that anyone giving you a reading, and they've set you up right. And that's the biggest secret, by the way, is to set people up. I tell people, when you're going to give someone a reading, you let them know that you've been doing this and you're very successful at it.
Uh-huh.
Okay? Then you let them know in subtle ways it takes two to tango. And so for the success of the reading, you have to do your part. And in a subtle way, you're putting the onus of the success or failure on them. Now you've got them, so they are going to work hard to make sure that this works.
They're invested, sure.
Right. So now, then you can tell almost anything, even outrageous stuff sometimes. And it's amazing how, if you get in the right mood, you can find some way of twisting it around to make sure, oh, yeah, that really is me, you know.
Uh-huh. Right. Ray Hyman's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the professor emeritus of psychology at the University of Oregon and a world-renowned skeptic, obviously because he's worked on both ends of things, cold readings, palmistry, you name it. 800-838-3760 if you'd like to join us on the exchange. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782 by email jx@jeffnet.org. Check us out on Facebook as well. So you make sure that you're saying things to people in such a way that they're embracing what you're telling them. They're
right.
Buying into it, basically.
That's right. And so the whole secret of cold reading and many other kinds of deceptions is you get the people to do themselves. They are fooling themselves, others. But the good thing about the human mind, as well as its weakness, is that it's creative. It's very flexible, and it could. Given the right motivation, it can turn anything into what you want it to be. And the cold reading is ideal in that sense because you can tell, if you set people up right, you can tell them almost anything, and they're going to twist it around and absorb it to make it fit themselves. And they're going to end up believing that you knew them better than their own parents and their own mother knows them, you know.
Is this sort of like what the efficiency experts used to refer to as the reactivity of response, where simply because people were being observed in their workplaces that they actually ended up speeding up just because they're being observed? In other words, that just because you know somebody's looking at you, your interest in the whole process is heightened?
I never made that connection, but it makes sense to me, yeah. I never thought of it that way, but yeah, I would think that. That's also related because what's related there in terms of the cold reading, when I'm giving you a cold reading, you are the center of the world universe for a moment. It's all about you. That's really a powerful thing in itself. And so you are being observed, right? But you are the center of attention during that whole reading. It's all about you.
Do you make sure if you're the cold reader that you put a couple of really nice things in there so that it builds up the, true or not, whether you think they're actually, you know, if they're part of your observations, are you just saying some nice things so the person gets puffed up enough to really own it even that much more?
Well, when I was in Harvard, I actually did some research on this experiments. What is the best mix of positive and negative statements and stuff like that? And the formula turned out to be quite simple. The best formula is tell people things they would like to be true of themselves, they like to hear, but they think is unique to them, even though these are things that everyone, that may be true of everyone, but there are a lot of things that people think are unique, not true of everyone, unique to themselves, but are positive. So you tell them statements like that, about two-thirds, and then one-third of statements you tell them things that are negative, that the people don't like to hear about themselves, but they are true about most of it. They're bad features of most people anyway, so they're not unique in having this negative. But that gives it plausibility, because if you told something everything is good about themselves, it doesn't make sense, even to someone who is naive. The simplest way, if you're just giving this, by the way, this is a reading where you don't give them a reading, literally. You just can give them a sheet of paper with the statements about themselves on it. Mm-hmm. And if you give them a sheet of paper where two-thirds of statements are good things, but are general, and one-third of statements seem like they are, they seem to be specific on the good things. And in reverse, if you give them a one-third of statements are negative statements, but are things that are probably true of everyone, too. Everyone's, a little procrastinator to some extent, stuff like that. Then that gives it some plausibility that this is, and people, if you gave them everything, said everything good about them, they become suspicious.
All right, cold readings with Ray Hyman, the University of Oregon psychology professor emeritus. As much as you have been lauded many times over for being a skeptic, you've apparently managed to stay on pretty good terms with the people whose beliefs you're putting under critical analysis.
I try, but it's not always the case. I get attacked, and used to be on the web, if you put my name there, you get a lot of scurrilous things about me. One that took me a while to figure out what they meant, they used to call me the Judas Goat of the CIA. And I found out the Judas Goat was in the Bible, the goat that they used to lead the lambs to slaughter. Mm-hmm. The lambs would follow the goat, and that's how they would lead them to slaughter. And when they said I was a Judas Goat for the CIA, because the CIA had hired me to evaluate this program on remote viewing that they had been sponsoring for actually 20 years almost. They actually sponsored for 5 years, and then the Department of Intelligence, DIA, took it over. And we actually had, our government actually had people who were doing remote viewing, as it's called. They were sort of psychics who, on call, could look, given the coordinates of a Russian base or something like that, they supposedly could lie down and psychically travel with their astral
projection,
to that site and tell the government what's going on there. These are called remote viewers. So we had a government program going on like that for almost 20 years. And I was hired, along with a parapsychologist, to evaluate the 20 years of accumulated scientific work they've been doing and actual projects where they actually use these people to help them supplement what their intelligence agencies were gathering. And as a result of that program, that evaluation, I concluded that there was nothing there. That whole 20 years was just money down the drain. And these remote viewers weren't really doing what they claim to do and so on. Well, that got a lot of nasty reaction from a lot of people. If you look in the web today, there are all kinds of websites on remote viewing, which will teach you for a lot of money. They'll teach you how to be a remote viewer and stuff like that. And there's a lot of money involved in it. But as a result, these people were very angry with me because I actually was the one who convinced the CIA to drop the program. And
so there was a revenue stream for them.
Right. But whatever it is, so they call me a Judas Goat for CIA. They said, I really know it works. But the CIA doesn't want the public to know that it works because this is how they manipulate the public,
Oh, so you're accused of the debunking it publicly but believing it privately,
right,
for the benefit of... Okay, that's a tricky one.
What they were meant by a Judas Goat. So I was leading the public to slaughter, basically.
All right, we'll have to figure out the psychology behind that one in just a few moments. Ray Hyman's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the University of Oregon. He talks about science and psychics and all kinds of other things that move from the normal into the paranormal. paranormal, and he's a skeptic. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from this break. Ray Hyman and you return in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking today about skepticism and deception in the field of psychology. Ray Hyman is a professor emeritus of psychology from the University of Oregon. He talks about science and psychics and where they cross and where they don't belong crossing either. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about belief and skepticism and deception. Our phone number is here, 800-838-3760 around the listening area. Our Rogue Valley local number, 541-552-6782. Our email address, jx@jeffnet.org. You can also check us out on Facebook. We took a picture of Ray before we got down to talking today. Is it true, Ray, you once held the spook chair at Stanford during a sabbatical from the U of O?
Yes, it's what they the people at Stanford call it. It's technically the Thomas Welton Stanford Chair for Psychical Research. Thomas Welton Stanford was the brother of Leland Stanford, who founded Stanford University. You know, he was a railroad magnate, and right. They put the money there. But he had a brother, Thomas Welton Stanford, who went to Australia and made his fortune there. But he got so seasick going there, he never left Australia. And at that time, it wasn't transatlantic flights sorts. While in Australia, Thomas Welton Stanford also became interested in spiritualism. And he went to seances, and he was convinced that this was real. So on his deathbed, he decided to leave all his fortune to Stanford, his brother's university, to study psychical research. And the president of Stanford University at that time was a man named Jordan, I think Leland Jordan, not Leland Jordan, but...
Jordan, anyway.
His last name was Jordan, anyway. Mm. He had, one of the early skeptics himself, he had... was the first guy to show up the rainmakers in California as frauds, you know. Mm-hmm. And so he sent his lawyers from Stanford University, his school of lawyers, to go to Australia, and they convinced Leland Stanford that in the United States we don't call it psychical research, we call it psychological research. So he left that big fortune to Stanford University for psychological research.
Uh-huh.
That's why, by the way, the psychology department at Stanford still is the world's greatest psychology department. At that time that they got their money, they had more money, as I recall, than all the other science departments that Stanford had.
Really?
In their budget, yeah.
Because of the spook chair.
Yeah. Well, there was a spook chair. What happened was they realized that the money really was meant to be, that he meant it for psychical research. So they decided, they took a little bit of their money from, and instead of using it for just psychology, they set up a chair for psychical research, and they had a man named Coover handle it, have that chair, and he did some psychical research for the first few years, but then he decided that there's nothing to it, so he did other things. When he retired in 1938, I think it was, they decided not to renew the chair, I mean, not to make a full-time appointment, but they would make it an annual appointment. They would point different people. Mm-hmm. But they never pointed a parapsychologist or a psychical researcher. They pointed skeptics or other people who did other things. So the parapsychological community became very incensed, and they led a campaign saying this should meant to be for psychical research. And so what they did then was they would invite people for a year there, but mostly invited skeptics like me.
Let's take a call. We have Al and Eugene on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking to Dr. Ray Hyman, Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the University of Oregon. Hi, Al.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call and talking to Professor Hyman. I have a couple of questions. One with regard to why is this belief of, I think they call it well witching for water.
Mm-hmm. Water witching, sure.
And the other thing is about a show, I don't see it anymore, but about this guy who talks to people and somehow he claims to be talking to their ancestors who are on the other side.
Oh, was that the crossing over with John Edward thing?
Right.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Yes.
All right. So water witching and talking to people's dead relatives.
Yes.
Good questions. Thanks for that, Al. Appreciate it.
You bet.
Okay. Well, 1959, when I was at Harvard, an anthropologist and I collaborated, and we did a lot of research on water witching. In fact, we did the only skeptical book there is, and still in print. It's called Water Witching USA. And there we go into the details about who does it, why it's done, the psychology of it. It's part of what we call idiomotor action, and I go into that in the book as well. It's related to the Ouija board and various other things. And I have an article also, which you can find on the web, called The Mischief Making of Idiomotor Action. I go into all the different ways, in medical and otherwise, that the tendency to unconsciously move your muscles in the ways that you're thinking. In other words, the divining rod, for example, is moved unconsciously by people because they know it should move that way. They unconsciously make it move, but they don't realize they're doing it. It's called idiomotor action. The idea that this, the rod should move this way, the pendulum should go this way, so on, comes out in muscular action, but it's below your level of consciousness, so you think someone else is doing it, some outside force is doing it. That's in a nutshell the basis of the water witching. But we did a study on 20,000 Dow. We found 20,000 Dowsers practicing in the United States back in the late 1950s. We reissued the book. We printed, I think the last edition was in 2000. So I think it's still in print, and you might find it in a library or something like that.
All right, so water witching is just your muscles doing things below your own conscious
level. Exactly, yeah.
Now, the other thing about, and I was going to ask you this when we got to the cold readings, was the discussion of talking to people's dead relatives or trying to figure out things that, you know, the old, well, they're trying to tell you to do X, you know. They're concerned about you because of such and such. I mean, how do you ascribe all that?
Yeah, well, that's easier to explain than even the cold reading itself, because if you don't have a conscience, anyone can do that. You can convince people you're talking to their dead relatives and stuff like that because they want that, want to believe that. And John Edward, for example, just one example of many of these mediums. He, the real father of all this, the way it's done now, the old-time mediums in the late 1800s and early 1900s in this country used to do everything in a dark seance room. And they also produced physical manifestations, stuff like that.
The kind of things that Harry Houdini debunked.
Right. And so, but modern mediums, beginning with George Anderson, get up in front of live audiences and do it on radio originally and then television. And they don't have to use any technique at all. John Edwards' technique is the same one that he borrowed from this guy, George Anderson, is when someone comes on the phone, you I'll from the audience wherever, and he immediately throws out names of all kinds. I said, I get John. Do you favor John? And if the person in the audience would say, no, I don't know a John, then he would say, oh, well, there's a lot of static between this world and the other world, so it's really Jim, I think. Jim. Do you know a Jim, you know? And the person would say, well, yeah, I know a Jim. And he would say, living or dead? And if the Jim he knows is living, then this is a message from the spirit world to Jim. If the person is dead, then Jim is trying to get a message through to you, you know. And if you notice that none of these people, including John Edward, ever uses a last name, it's always a first name. I was on a, with this George Anderson many years ago on a Larry King live show. I was on with this George Anderson I was supposed to be the poo-poo guy, the debunker.
Right.
But I didn't have to do any debunking. And this one, everything was rare, worked itself out this way, because the very first person who called in, George Anderson, said, I get a John. Do you know a John? Do you ever know a John? And this woman sounded like she's about 65 or so. She says, no. And he says, you never knew a John? She says, no. And he says, oh, wait a minute. It really is Joe. Joe, did you ever know a Joe? She says, no. And he goes, never know. Never. And this went on, and she didn't recognize any name he threw out.
Uh-huh.
And this usually is going to be some one name. And it turned out, afterwards I realized this woman was calling from New Mexico. I think she was on the reservation. Mm-hmm. She's an Indian, and most Indians don't have John. And John Doe,
yeah. Instant debunking. We're talking to Ray Hyman, a professor emeritus of psychology at the University of Oregon, about his work in the field of skepticism. Now, you're a fellow of the Committee for Skeptical Inquiry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about some of the organizations you've been part of, and you've created things like the Skeptics Toolbox as well.
Right. Actually, in 1972, I was asked by the Defense Department to go down and look at this guy, Uri Geller. That time, no one knew about him, right?
Yeah, the spoon-bending guy?
Right. Mm-hmm. He was being studied at Stanford Research Institute by two physicists. And they were trying to get money from the Defense Department, actually from ARPA, the Advanced Research Projects Agency of the Defense Department, which at that time was working on the ARPANET, which later became the Internet.
Internet, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But this was 1972. And the head of ARPA, Colonel... this colonel who's head of ARPA, I knew him because he was also a PhD in psychology, mm-hmm. but he was a colonel in the Air Force, and he was the acting head of ARPA. He called me, and he said, Ray, he says, could you go down to, I was at Oregon at that time, I was in the middle of grading exams at that time, too, and he said, could you drop whatever you're doing and go down right away to Stanford Research Institute? We'd like you to go there to look at this, what they're doing with this guy called Uri Geller. Because, you know, he does what most psychics can do, but he also can bend metal with his minds, and this could be of great interest to the Defense Department. And I had visions of them thinking of Geller thinking and bending Russian tanks with his mind, something like that. But anyway, this sounded weird to me.
Sure.
I hadn't heard of Geller at that time. In fact, no one in this country had heard of him at that time. And he said he's also sending a... he wants a three-man committee. He's sending a parapsychologist as well, because his notion, his thinking, is the way our Defense Department thinks. The notion was that if there's anything to this guy, he's going to take a parapsychologist to see it. On the other hand, if there's any hanky-panky going on, it's going to take someone like me to see it. And they were very much afraid of getting bad publicity if they got involved with a trickster, because there was a senator, Proxmire.
Wisconsin, the Golden Fleece Award.
Golden Fleece Award. And any department of the government that got a Golden Fleece Award would take a big hit in their budget. Mm-hmm. And the Defense Department didn't want to risk that. So that's why I was being sent, in case the guy was a phony. And, of course, I went and spent a day watching them, working with Geller and watching Geller and stuff like that. And I reported back to the Defense Department that Geller is a charming con artist and doesn't have a psychic bone in his head. You know, I mean, he's just a trickster. On the other hand, the parapsychologist reported back and said he's real. but the people there don't know how to study him. If you give me the money, I will do the research correctly. You know.
So what was the technique there? How was Uri Geller bending the spoons or appearing to bend the spoons?
By trickery. And he wasn't very good, but he's not a very good magician, by the way. But he doesn't have to be. See, people don't understand that he doesn't have to bend the metal in a ways that is really as good as Randy can do it, for example, or even I can do it. I can bend metal, the spoons, better than he can in terms of from technique. But he doesn't have to do that because he is bending people's minds. He's a good psychologist, and he's got this... aura. He's got this way of imposing his will on people, and it doesn't make a difference what he does. But he's actually pretty crude compared to what magicians do. When he bends your spoon, you change your religion.
Uh-huh.
I bend your spoon, you sue me for destroying your metal.
There's a bit of a difference there. Ultimately, does it get down to we want to believe? We do want to believe in things that can't really be explained?
Yeah, but it's not as simple as that, because all of us want to believe, even the skeptics we'd like to believe those things as well. It's a difference between some other things involved as well. In other words, what prior exposure you've had, what prior information you've had, how much you're willing to not use your brains in order to defend your into something you want to believe. It, but it's not as simple as that. And that's why I study it. I'm very fascinated by studying scientists, for example, who have done great things, but at the same time have also been taken in by phony psychics. You know, Geller would be one example. Mm-hmm. Many scientists actually embarrassed themselves because they committed themselves to believing in him and felt because they're great scientists, they can make the distinction between what is trickery and what is not, which they can't. You know, scientists are easy to fool. They're not experts in magic or trickery, you know.
Well, which explains your talk yesterday about scientists and psychics and why competent scientists become completely incompetent when testing psychics. It's been a great pleasure to talk to you. Dr. Ray Hyman is the Professor Emeritus of Psychology at the University of Oregon. Thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
You're welcome.
I want to let our listeners know sometime within the next hour, the News and Information Service will experience a few brief outages. Our engineers are rerouting power to an alternate source here in the JPR studios. The outages should be relatively brief. We appreciate your patience as the work gets completed. If you're listening in the morning, the takeaway is coming up next. If you're listening to our evening rebroadcast, we're followed by news from the BBC. The Jefferson Exchange is produced by Charlotte Dern of JPR News. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us again tomorrow at 8 for another edition of the Jefferson Exchange here on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio, and have a great day.